at last bowed in divinal sag, steady cranking, incremental tilt of dentist age examination chair, the patient's eyes listed. Above him, the ceiling attic slope adorned a portrait boy, small as a postcard and copper framed. Such a perfect spherical head against a square of black, a brooch-wearing little lord, ermine-cloaked overlooker with benign features. Does his content smile bend for gems, his strands of pearls? No, that's not it. A little egg of a boy, centered just so, to sway the patient. Ignore the trilling tooth, the drill's burr, the metal hook, the dentist's index finger coated in a bittersweet latex powder. Reflect on roundness and something princely, an ebony recorder on a velvet cushion, a toy drum with a leopard skin strap, a croaking frog inside of a silver filigree cage. The patient lifted his head, and the dentist alligator clipped a dimpled paper bib around his neck. He untangled cold bib chain from a curl of gray nape hair and asked the dentist if the portrait on the ceiling bothered him. "Though I share the office with three others, the portrait was my addition," said the dentist. "He's my patron saint, the young czar, Peter the Great. I am intimate with his expression and mean for my patients to commit it to memory." The dentist rolled towards the patient on his white plastic stool. The patient could still see the dark shape of the dentist's mustache beneath the teal mask. "You may have heard some awful things about Peter the Great. He was an amateur dentist and hardly reformed a young discipline, thoroughly barbaric." The dentist paused and probed the stub of the patient's buckled molar with a blunt tool. A whimper. The pain unraveled down from the tooth through his jaw. It was sewn in under his right collarbone, gathered up and billowed at the hair of his armpit. The dentist sighed. His mentor was the consummate anatomist Frederick Ruysch. Together they started with rotten teeth, pulled them from the mouths of the Tsar's servants and adversaries with an iron tooth key, the grip of carved ivory ornamented with a bar of mother-of-pearl. In his journals, the Tsar said his mentor extolled his gentleness and the smooth and quick grace of his extractions. The patient lifted his hand off his thighs and waved them. He tried to speak of his discomfort over the hiss of the suction tube and the precise clicking of the pick on his undamaged teeth. The dentist set down his tools. "Please." He pushed the patient's hands down. "I want you to appreciate what I'm telling you. It's appropriate to your condition, the molar I can't save." The Tsar, the dentist explained, honed his art in the depleted mouths of his adversaries. Each man was meant to understand the Tsar's mercy as he screamed and spat blood into a pewter goblet. His allies lost healthy teeth too, but with the succor of opiates. The teeth the Tsar took, he studied them carefully. He called them the seeds of the new empire. The dentist rubbed a bitter numbing gel on the inflamed gum of the patient's injured tooth, the crown lost when the patient was felled by heat stroke. The patient's tongue folded away from the taste. A pretty arc of saliva, it issued from the underside of his tongue and onto the dentist's white sleeve. "I have something. It'll help me administer the anesthetic." The dentist opened a drawer and placed heavy padded headphones over the patient's ears, the coiled cord stretching taut. No music, not a sound. When the dentist spoke again, his voice was undampened by mask and headphones. "Imagine a room piled high with a burlap sacks, mounds of teeth, a treasury of teeth. Peter the Great kept his favorites in specimen drawers, each tooth tied to each neighbor with a pale blue satin ribbon. The dentist claimed he had seen them during a pilgrimage to the Tsar's Kunstkamera, an incisor of pure white with dark amber roots, a black tooth shaped like the head of a horned devil, a piteously small molar from a deceased child, a heart-shaped premolar from a cousin the Tsar wished to marry. The voice, parted between padded foam and covered mouth, puckered corally. The patient felt a dissociative pain, a ticklish malformed channel he could not follow from jaw to heel. this procedure, this dentist. He did not understand what the man wanted beyond the uprooting of the tooth. Sealing word. He sought in the face of the child czar some split, some ill fold or misalignment. Nothing. He cupped one hand against the other hand. Unseen weight touched his palms, a cold pear shape. The wounded room, a seed bank, has a doorway, four walls, and a ceiling of comforting height. The room is storage, the visitor is storage, and the ceiling, lenient to the state of accumulation, retreats imperceptibly. A man could be said to be a seed, a woman a seed, but a man and the woman are not the seeds they want. Where is the seed? They say the one they want does not yet exist. A seed may come when the visitor yields to the room. They want the visitor, a woman, or sometimes a man, to sit and wait. The floor is best. It has recently been refinished and polished shines on the narrow planks. They would like the visitor to touch the planks and admire the texture. Is it not soft? A superior floor, a floor sanded by hand, is neither over-waxed nor a perfect plane. The fingers and the soles of the feet detect subtle ridges, the old scratches, the character of the wood. Uncountable interiors contain one wounded room, sometimes more. Does it come as a surprise that the wounded room is common? No primed space alone will produce a seed. A wounded room requires a visitor and a witness, an uncommon meeting. They keep a large map with pins in it, black-headed pins for wounded rooms, blue-headed pins for the visitor, and on idle evenings, emptied of pins, the sheet of worn paper manifests a network of small cavities. They wish for more success, but have grown circumspect. They would like the visitor to sit comfortably, but not to feel at home. The last seed surfaced in a wounded room, without a visitor, observed by a witness in her kitchen. Did she feel like a guest in her own home? It is a rarity. Rare as a seed. Will the seed be fruitful? Will the seed mature into a bell? They do not know. I think they are scared to plant it, fearful that it would push from the earth unsound. The room where they store the rare seed is off-limit to visitors and witnesses. It is no longer a wounded room. From the outside, the room has a blue-trimmed window with darkly stained wooden shutters. On the inside, the window has been secreted behind plaster and new paint. Someone has hung a handsome old mirror edged in gilt-carved acorns. Tell me, what good ever comes from an obstruction? Once, during his youth, Peter the Great removed an abscess tooth from a woodsman. In gratitude, the woodsman said he would cut down the greatest larch in the forest near his village. I will send the timber to a craftsman, and he will make you a throne that will honor your skill, said the woodsman. I have a throne, said Peter the Great, but I do need a fine cabinet to house my collections from my travels abroad. The woodsman found a suitable tree in early autumn, the time of year when his incessant work shrunk the fat of his thick skin, obliged his bones to suffer the cold. It took 14 days to fell the larch, though the woodsman, roiled by his labors, did not notice the time. Whenever he paused to rest his hands and remove his rabbit fur gloves, he put his tongue in the gap where he had once possessed a blackened canine. Oh, he said. He couldn't think of the proper words with which to praise the slippery vault. After the larch groaned and tipped to beat the earth with splintered weight, the woodsman hired a team of 20 horses to drag the trunk along the soggy road to the village. A superstitious man, the woodsman remained in the forest to perform a rite his mother had taught him. If you cut down a great tree, burn the stump and bury a silver coin 6 arms lengths beneath the ashes. When the hole was deep and the dirt and ash were heaped high, his spade resounded against something hard. It might not be a rock, thought the woodsman. He parted roots gently, dug with his hands so he wouldn't harm what he couldn't see. Uncovered, a head-sized bronze bell, green with age, steamed in a call of roots. The woodsman placed the larch bell in a beaverskin sack and sent it to the court. When the larch cabinet was complete, the topmost compartment was inlaid with lapis lazuli tiles, and the bell was closed within. Peter the Great only heard its peal once. The sound was said to have been so spirited that the Tsar writhed in fits of twitching and ecstasy whenever he recalled it. Acquisitive space, architecture that desires, upsets the mode of how we settle in the personal and find peace in routines. That is how I define the wound. The appellation itself can be traced back to a palimpsest, the Brayer text destroyed in the bombardment of Belgrade in 1915. The original language of the Brayer text was withheld. Some claim it was written in Japanese, other Urdu, perhaps Portuguese, but of three extant translations conducted near the end of the 19th century by a Seoul scholar, only one contains the words wounded room. But, the translator claimed, in a sheaf of letters found after his death in a Kentucky sanatorium, I hadn't endeavored to write three translations in the reading room. There was one translation and two copies. Over time, all three shifted, and there are hardly any of my words left in them. The libraries they keep, some small and packed hastily into a suitcase, fail to persevere. It was, at first, a painful lesson, the discovery that evidence committed to paper pulp from a bell tree lends itself to addendum, reiterates the scrape erasures of bellum. Now they refrain from claiming authorship over anything. They delight in the contradictions of an over-annotated oral tradition, texts that self-reject. On infrequent occasions, when there is time for a visitor to prepare for the wounded room, for the possibility of a seed, they advise a reading ceremony. The few of us within our small community who joined as visitors and now witness the rite do so with a joyful ache that transcends jealousy towards the newly initiated. Expectant, the shell scraper wed a virgin, impatient to secure strong sons. But she brought emptiness into his home, a broken bell between her legs. He took his wife to the old persimmon woman for a remedy. The persimmon woman said, no good, and gave the lack a name. Affronted, he left the lack and his wife with the persimmon woman. But the old woman had tricked the shell scraper. Your bell, said the persimmon woman, is not broken. Your fearsome children refuse to leave the wounded room. They do not wish to be animals. A bell like yours rings with an unseen flame. To release your children, it must be extinguished. The persimmon woman sacrificed a small tortoise. She stripped the shell from the body and filled it with the animal's blood. The abandoned woman kneeled with the tortoise shell beneath her bell for 5 days and 5 nights, until the blood offering reached her children in the wounded room. I'm not allowed to tell you what they have become, but know that your children are sorry they've made you a solitary, said the persimmon woman. They want you to have a gift. The solitary took a hand mirror from the persimmon woman. She followed mirror rules, to keep it covered, to never let another person see it. And if she looked into it, with ceaseless pleasure, to see the immaculate room never inhabited by a person. And if she broke it, the everlasting wrath of her children forced into blood and limbs. Thank you.